Welcome, everyone, to the Unbox Some Funcast, a podcast about being on the front line of the games industry. I am one of your hosts, Kylie. I'm joined, as always, today with Chandra. Chandra, how are you doing today?
Great, Kylie. About you?
Not too bad. This is an episode I'm really excited about because this episode is kind of going over exactly what I wanted this podcast to be, which is what it means to run a friendly local game store, what role we serve in the tabletop gaming hobby. It's why we call the podcast Being on the Front Lines of the Games Industry. This episode is being recorded on November 6th, 2025. And Chandra, I say we just dive right in. What does it mean to be on the front line of the games industry?
This is an incredibly important topic. We made it our tagline for a reason, and I think it's something a lot of game stores all over the place around the country, probably around the world, can get behind, at least to some degree, that we are not just in the business of selling games. We're in the business of growing the community of people who want to interact with games. And I think a lot of the most successful game stores find their niche within that particular function. And we all have to play that role to some degree.
There aren't a lot of podcasts about game stores, particularly in my mind, obviously biased, but in my mind, how important they are is not represented by the other types of social media. More stores are doing social media like we are now, which is great, but not a lot of podcasts compared to lots of podcasts from publishers about the publishing side of things, from designers, from news outlets, right? There's a lot of that out there. And as I was doing a survey of some of this stuff, I really couldn't find anything that was from the perspective of a game store. I think that also speaks to a feeling that a lot of game stores have that we are sometimes ignored by the greater games industry. I have felt that sometimes, but I hear a lot of complaints about that from other retailers. You know, we are part of the Trade Association for Tabletop Games, who, you know, retailers make up the largest slice of members of that organization. And yet so much talk is about publishers, about designers. Again, they changed it from, it used to be called the Game Manufacturers Association. They've eliminated that. It's just the acronym GAMA now. As a nod to, there's more than just the publishers as part of this industry. But I wouldn't mind talking a little bit about why sometimes, whether it's valid or not, game stores feel a little bit like they are the bottom part, as it were, of the industry and don't get that sort of respect. Do you have some thoughts on that, Chandra?
I think a lot of it has to do with the prevalence of social media and the internet being a lot of people's primary means of accessing information and accessing other people. I remember a podcaster, reviewer type of individual in the tabletop gaming industry many years ago said that local game stores are pointless. They don't need to exist. They should just go away. We have the internet now. And I think time has shown, and that was a decade or so ago, if memory serves, I think time has shown that that was dead wrong. That attitude was never accurate. And I think it's become less and less accurate, but the mindset has not necessarily gone away. People think that brick and mortar was somehow made obsolete by Amazon.com, but we've found in other industries, for example, independent bookstores have been exploding over the past decade. Game stores, I think, are similar. We've seen a bit of an explosion of local game stores over the past few years.
You hit on something too there with having, a lot of it has to do with perception, the stuff we see on social media, which is obviously always going to skew a certain way. One, it's going to skew to the negative. So there's going to be, you know, if a high profile or even mid profile content creator or publisher, we've had publishers sometimes look askance and say negative things about game stores in the past. that's just going to get more hits than the positive statements being made about game stores. It's the way our society is and the way social media wires our brain to look for the negative. But I think there's also another perceptual thing, which is the industry is so future-looking when it comes to social media. The content creators are constantly being sent stuff that's about to go on Kickstarter. Right? They're going to cons. They want to talk about the brand new thing that either just came out or is coming out very soon, because that's what gets hits. That's what gets eyeballs. And as a game store, we are not focused. We are definitely not focused on the future, right? We are immediate impulse. We're going to talk about things that you can buy today. That's a thing that's often happened with me. You know, people have asked me, oh, will you talk about this on your social media channel? Will you talk about my upcoming thing? Like, no, I literally only ever want to talk about things that I can sell you today.
I think a lot of publishers and designers might not see that from our angle too, because they are trying to get pre-orders on these things, as you say, very future-facing. Whereas if we talk about something that we cannot sell to a person today, that actually gets us negative attention. It's a bad look for us, because then our customers are disappointed that if they walk into the store, that thing that is being hyped up is not on our shelves. So if we're the ones talking about it and we cannot sell it, we are purveying disappointment rather than fun.
Yeah, it's actually one of those little skills, and I know we're going to talk about the skills that game store employees need to have a little bit later, but one of those little skills is a constant awareness of what is out of stock. Either temporarily, you know, like just we literally sold our last copy, or this has been between print runs, because, yeah, the last thing we want to do is have a customer come in and say, oh, do you have a game that does XYZ? And go, I got the perfect game for you. It is this game that we don't have right now. We have to focus on what we can sell today. You know, another thing, and this is a reason that publishers often don't focus as much their marketing efforts on marketing to game stores. And I understand this and I sympathize with it, which is that there are very few chains, game store chains. There's a few, I could name a couple of them. But even those chains, they might have 6 or 7 stores. Every store is so idiosyncratic. The games that work at Games Unlimited may not work with the focus of the games that work at Mimics Market, which is another friendly local game store right here in Pittsburgh. To say, hey, I'm going to put my marketing dollars into getting game stores to carry my game, it's not going to pay out the dividends, because, you know, even if Games Unlimited loves a game, like our best-selling numbers of games in a given year are 1 to 200 copies. That's a drop in the bucket to a print run, you know. Obviously, they will focus, you know, if they're going to sell to Barnes & Noble and Target and they got those buyers' ears, yeah, that is going to get them a lot of sales. But game stores themselves, individually, we are a drop in the bucket. And it's very hard to actually market to all of us at once in a meaningful way.
Yeah, that's a really good point. And it actually circles back, interestingly, to the topic of future facing, talking about new games, right? Because what's new on the internet is different from what's new in a game store. What's new on the internet is whatever is entering its crowdfunding phase that week, or whatever a publisher says, hey, this is going up for pre-order in 2 days. That's what's new on the internet. What's new in a game store is what is new to us as human individuals, what we have just brought into the store, what we are hyped and excited about, which might be something that has been around for 6 months, but that we only just got hands on and decided this is way better than we thought it looked, so we're going to bring it in and talk to people about it. And so that cycles in with that idiosyncrasy, where what has us excited, what's on the tip of our frontal lobes, is not necessarily going to coincide with what's on the hotness list on BoardGameGeek.
And let's not forget our customers. What's new to our customers is anything they haven't seen before. People that walk into the store are like, ooh, this Ticket to Ride, is this new? I've never heard of it before. Mm-hmm. It's new to you. No one in the hobby would consider Ticket to Ride new, but nope. That doesn't matter.
And importantly, it's our job not to make that person feel small for never having heard of that game before. And that's something you will run into in other venues. And I think that's also part of what makes our job different.
Right.
You know, our job is to make that person's excitement grow, not to tamp it down. Hey, this Ticket to Ride thing one of my friends just told me about, I've never heard of it before, is this a brand new game? My job is not to be like, you rube, that game's been around for decades. It's to be like, no, that game's been around for a while, but let me tell you why it is such a huge seller and why your friend was so excited to introduce you to it. And I think that really feeds into why we exist.
This is one of the things, again, going back to why sometimes game stores feel like or are actually disparaged. People really deep in the hobby will come in and want the new thing. Sometimes it's on Kickstarter. They don't realize it's on Kickstarter. Or, you know, don't realize how many new games there are. Expect a game store to have every single new game the day it comes out. And that's just not feasible. We've had people say to us, well, you know, you're not a very good game store because you don't have this game that just shipped via Kickstarter, right? Or you don't have this new game, which we could have got, but there's 100 new games we could get every week. We've got to be selective. We've got to pick and choose. And that's, honestly, that comes from just not understanding all of what goes into running a game store and all the decisions that we have to make, right? And that we can't just be, we can't be, frankly, Amazon that has everything in stock at all times.
But it also speaks to one of our strengths. A lot of the time, what someone who's waist deep into the hobby sees as a weakness in a game store is a strength whenever we are trying to expand the hobby. If a person off the street who is pretty new to this stuff, who's played some games of Catan and Ticket to Ride and maybe a little Dominion, if they walk in and see one of literally everything, that actually does not help that person. That leads to, at best, analysis paralysis. Their jaw hits the floor, they wander around for a few minutes, and then they leave. What does help that person is our conscious and deliberate curation. So we intentionally don't try to carry every single brand new thing that comes out. We try to carry the new things and the older things that are really excellent examples of whatever it is they are doing. I think that moves into what we're really here for. And you and I have said this in probably every single episode of this that we've recorded, plus a lot of our online videos, that we see our job a lot as education and outreach and growing the hobby. All of that ties into making sales and making money, and both sides have to support each other, but we need to be growing the hobby. We need to be growing the audience, and you don't do that by just aiming a fire hose at them as soon as they walk in the door.
You have to recognize that game stores exist on a spectrum of more focused on very specific games to focused on lots of games. Because we talk about growing the hobby, but I do think we need to be more granular. Growing more tabletop gamers in general, or growing more CCG players, or even more specifically, growing more Pokemon players. And what I mean by that is, you know, this spectrum, there are many stores that downplay board games and indie RPGs, which is our focus, so we might put us on one end of the spectrum, and they're favoring lifestyle games. And what we mean by lifestyle games are games that a person, let's take Magic for example, many people would consider themselves a Magic player, but not a gamer. They don't play a lot of games. They don't consider their hobby playing a lot of games, but their passion, their identity is around playing Magic or playing D&D or playing Warhammer. When it comes to board games or indie RPGs, more often than not, players don't say, hey, I'm a Ticket to Ride player. They say, I'm a board gamer. They like try lots of different things. They don't say, hey, I'm a Thirsty Sword Lesbians player. They say, I play RPGs. I like to try different things. And so, you know, a lot of game stores, their focus is being a place to play and growing in wonderful ways, growing hobbyists of a certain ilk. And for us, you know, I just sort of have the philosophy, one, we like board games and indie RPGs, that's where our focus is. But also, if I'm a CCG-focused store, yes, I can grow the hobby, but there's a lot of limitations to that. There's a very certain style of play and want to interact with a game to get someone into CCGs. Or minis, for example. Minis are so much, it's part playing, it's part painting, all of those things are great, but there's a certain customer type that might walk into your store that it doesn't matter how good you are, you're not going to get them to play Warhammer. Whereas yeah. With something that's a bit more broad, like indie RPGs and board games, I'll find something that works for that.
Yeah, it's interesting. You can see parallels in other hobbyist markets and industries. I was just listening recently to a podcast about Nintendo. And when you look at the video games industry over the past four decades, Nintendo, until pretty recently, set themselves well apart from a lot of the others. And one of the reasons for that is two of the movers and shakers in Nintendo were Gunpei Yokoi, who worked there starting in the 1960s when Nintendo was mostly a playing card company. He moved them into toys, and then eventually he was the reason why they moved into video games. And Satoru Iwata, who unfortunately died far too young, but he was the president of Nintendo for a while. And he and Gunpei Yokoi together had this philosophy where they talked about the blue ocean versus the red ocean. And they said companies like Sega, back when they were doing hardware, or Sony and Microsoft are in the red ocean. So Nintendo is going to go out into the blue ocean. And the red ocean, that's blood red. It is red because it is these companies fighting tooth and nail over an increasingly specialized audience, an audience that cares about the highest tech, about the best graphics, the fastest processors, and on and on. And there's always a new thing to upgrade to. Think about collectible card games in that sense. Think about miniatures games, Warhammer, in that sense, right? And then there's us. We're like Gunpei Yokoi and Satoru Iwata sailing out into the blue ocean. And there's other boats out there with us, but we're not fighting over this tiny, tiny audience. We are expansive in our point of view, and we're trying to increase the overall space that we're in, rather than fighting over what can be in that space.
I really like that metaphor. I hadn't heard that before, Chandra. That's really cool. Nowadays, video games are pervasive. I mean, everyone's got, you know, your grandmother plays Candy Crush on her phone, right? That is pervasive. But going back to when we were growing up, oh no, Nintendo, that's kids, that's primarily boys. You know, getting my mother to play a video game, frankly, was like getting most people to play a board game nowadays. It's just not thought of as something that everybody does.
And you see that with Nintendo, with the Game Boy, which did gangbusters among demographics that home consoles did not. My mother played Tetris on my Game Boy all the time. You saw it with the Wii in a huge way. And where Nintendo tends to falter is always when they veer off back into the Red Ocean, away from that expansive approach to things. And yeah, you're exactly right that video games were nerdy, geeky, niche boy things, except for some things that weren't, and those things were almost always Nintendo for a reason.
Looking at this Blue Ocean, Red Ocean thing, I'm thinking a little bit about how publishers are often marketing their games. It's going to depend on the publisher, but it leads me to a couple of different things related to game stores, which is what types of games actually work well in a game store versus what don't, because there are definitely differences. I mentioned earlier, we don't sell, can't sell everything. But I think if you have got a $200 campaign game full of miniatures, that's probably a crowdfunding thing. Your audience already knows games of that type. You need to target them directly. And someone walking into a game store who's not into this hobby, even if we have that game on our shelves, that's not a game we're recommending as a starting point for something in this hobby. But what that also tells me is they are sailing in that red ocean you talk about. Guess what? There's a lot of companies out there crowdfunding big, epic, $200-$300 campaign minis, heavies games. And I'm not going to name names, but one of the biggest players ain't doing so hot anymore in that
True.
space. And it's
Very true.
because, a lot of reasons potentially, but they've adopted that red ocean philosophy. It's like, we're going to try to be the best at this thing that is still very niche, and we can't grow the customer base for it. We're just going to try to get all the people that are already in that customer base.
And this isn't even a better or worse thing. It's just different approaches, and each one has strengths and weaknesses. Each one has its own particular challenges you have to meet. In the Red Ocean philosophy, to just keep using that metaphor, more and more games means each game has to fight harder and harder for its share of the audience and its dollars. Whereas whenever you take the more expansive approach, and you see some companies trying their hand at that, like Chip Theory recently released basically a family card game. It will be interesting to see if some other companies out there do decide, hey, maybe we've gotten what we can scrapping tooth and claw. Let's try a different venue. But again, different challenges you have to face. And even in that blue ocean, the challenge really is us having to be well informed about what games we have on the shelves. And this is another point we've made before. There's absolutely no way all of us can play every single game we bring in. There's not time in the day. A lot of us have families and other obligations. As much as we'd love it if we could play games all the time, we still want to know as much as we can about as many of these as we can so that we can try to match the games to the right people. Because matching games to people is exactly the thing that makes people feel welcome in this space.
I'd like to use that to lead into how what we do is different than how other parts of the industry are selling games. Obviously, there's the internet, there's Board Game Geek advertising. That's its own thing. That is a cottage industry of learning exactly how to market to the people most likely to buy your game. So that's something separate. But I think if we really want to compare and contrast something, let's compare it to selling a game at a con, right? So cons, conventions, are generally the place where publishers are most directly interacting face to face and trying to sell their game to the end user. It's the closest environment to publishers experiencing what game stores experience day in and day out. And they are radically different. But I think by showing them next to each other, we can talk about that. And this is something I would have had a harder time talking about a year ago because I had never demoed a game at a con before PAX Unplugged last year. In fact, I think I made a video saying I'd be terrible at working a booth at a con because my inclination would be, tell me about what games you like. Oh, go over to that other booth over there. You want to play that game. I'd be hard pressed to try to sell the specific game or games that I was doing. wasn't actually my experience. And I hadn't gone into it intending to work at a booth. I was at PAX Unplugged for the first time. One of my friends from childhood, Tim Fowers, has his own game company now, Fowers Games. And he was there at PAX. And one day, someone didn't show up, one of the volunteers, and asked if I'd fill in for a few hours. And I said, sure. So it was a very interesting experience, but also lets me know this is how publishers, assumingly, view selling their game directly to the end consumer, which is very different from how we do it here in the store. And I think one of the first things is what you just said, Chandra. You know, if you're working at a booth, I mean, if you're working at a huge booth, I'm thinking Allplay, right? Allplay is going to be demoing at least a dozen of their games at any con. And I don't know what kind of training goes into their volunteers. And I use the term volunteer. Sometimes people are paid. That's a whole other thing. But I do know that they're scheduled. Hey, you're going to go demo this game for the next hour or two. I don't know that they necessarily learn all 12 games. But again, I'm going to say that 12 is like the max, probably, that someone at a booth is expected to know. Often you might be at a booth with just one game. This is the one game we're showing off. The company may have a lot of games, but they're only going to show off, you know, promote a specific games. I was working at Fowers, and there were like three games over the course of the hour that I rotated in and out of demoing. That's very different than someone walks into the store. Even if we just look at the new releases, let's say someone limits themselves and says, hey, tell me about what's new this week. That's dozens of games. How do game store employees know them all? Do they play them all?
Well, a lot of it is information sharing. We have to democratize the job. So I will know some games because they happen to fit into certain niches that really interest me. And Dan, the other manager, will know certain other games because they excite him and Kristen and Mike and Andrew and Gwen. Everyone will have games that jump out at them and they just have to rip open and learn. If I know a game pretty well, and it's not necessarily up Kristen's alley, but she's going to need to talk about it with someone. She and I will talk about the game. She'll ask questions about it until she feels like she has a decent understanding of it. Or someone comes in and asks me about a game that I haven't played, but I'm like, hey, Kristen, you and your group are into this kind of game. Have you played this one yet? Could you walk over and walk me and the customer through it together? And then the customer gets to hear about the game from someone who's played it and is passionate about it. And I get the education as well because I'm standing there listening, and I can use that information with the next customer that asks about it when Kristen isn't there. And it might sound, speaking of it in the abstract, kind of disingenuous, but in reality, enthusiasm is infectious in every direction. So just because I haven't played a game yet doesn't mean that my speaking excitedly and enthusiastically about it is anything other than sincere because two things. I heard Kristen talk about how great this game was with that last customer. Now I'm excited about it. I actually want to try this game that I was paying no mind to before. Plus, man, Kristen's description of it made it sound like the perfect game for this guy and his family, and I'm excited for them to get hands on it. So the enthusiasm actually does spread in this really organic way along with the knowledge.
What you said there is key. You, what you've learned about the game, you know how to turn that into when to recommend this game to someone else. It's not just being able to talk about a game when someone asks us about that game. It's about what we've learned about that game, internalizing it, what sort of mechanisms are there, how does it feel, so that even if we haven't played it, when someone comes in and says, I'm looking for a game that does XYZ, that can be one of the options. This is hugely important to being someone who works in a retail game store because your average person who plays games is evaluating games, you know, at worst, they're just evaluating them based on, I like it, I don't like it. And maybe at best, they're evaluating, like, will my group like it? But us, Chandra, what you said about the excitement, I think it's absolutely genuine. And it's a genuine excitement for when we know that's the right pick for someone.
That's it.
I may love, absolutely love Final Girl, and I do. I want to talk about Final Girl all the time. If someone comes in, though, and they're like, you got any good solo games? And I'm like, ooh, Final Girl. Let me walk them over there. And I go, hey, do you like horror movies? And they're like, no, I hate horror movies. I am not excited to talk to them about Final Girl.
Yep.
There's no excitement there because I know that's not the right fit. But I may be very excited to talk to them about Conservas. Right? They come in and they're like, I really like Scott Alms games. Like, he's a great designer. I'm like, you know, he has a new solo game. I'm going to get excited about it in that situation. So that enthusiasm really has to be placed in the right place and time for that person and that interaction.
Well, and that goes back to your experience at the booth. Limitations breed creativity. And when you're limited to talking about 3 to 6 games or whatever it is at the booth, you have to be enthusiastic about those games, which means you've got to know those games reasonably well and be able to pass that enthusiasm along to other people in a way that is genuine, because people will smell if you are faking it. People will smell if you actually think this game is hot garbage. In that way, it's not that dissimilar from what we do in the store, because we are always going to veer toward the games that we think are a better fit. When you've got those 3 games at the booth and you have to limit yourself to those, if someone expresses that one of those 3 games is absolutely unattractive to them, you're going to go to the other 2 very naturally. It's not even a conscious decision. It's just, okay, social cues have told me that one is out of the running. Let's look at these 2. And you just have to pivot. Whether you're dealing with 6 games or 600 games, you have to be able to pivot and follow the customer's enthusiasm.
Many of our people listening to this, many of our customers have spent many, many hours at booths. I've just spent a couple, so it's not my main thing. But one of the things I realized is that people are there to buy. They're at a con. They're already gamers. And it wasn't necessarily, different people run the booths differently. It wasn't my job to snag someone walking by and say, hey, come look at this, right? It was a lot of waiting until they already expressed a little bit of interest, because You don't want to waste your time trying to show someone a game that they're not interested in, because the person behind them may have been interested, but they moved on because you grabbed the person in front of them or you're in the middle of something. So there's definitely much more of an art form of knowing when this person's not interested and giving them an out, which is something we do develop at the game store. If I'm showing you something, I can tell you're not interested. I could be like, let's move on to something else.
And that's a real skill before we move on from that. I just really want to emphasize that point. That is a real skill to develop, and it's very important. Giving the customer an out that doesn't make them feel like they have to fight themselves free, because that's going to sour the whole interaction.
Yeah. I mean, it's something I've heard other retailers talk about this in seminars they gave on demoing, which is like, you got to have the 10-second pitch, the 30-second pitch, and the 2-minute pitch. Give them the 10-second pitch. If they're interested, then you move on to the 30-second. If they're still interested, you move on to the 2-minute. You can't start with the 2-minute. They may want out. So that was eye-opening, just that different feel of things. And again, knowing my job here is to, at best, you know, at worst, if you're really just trying to shill a game, you're like, I want to get as many people to buy this game as possible. But at best, even when you're at a booth, it's as quickly as possible, discover if this game is right for the person who just walked up, Right. Or maybe there's another game at this booth that's perfect. But they're in a different mindset than when they come into a retail store. A word, a phrase that comes up a lot when it comes to game stores, this has been a buzzword for game stores for the past 10 plus years, is a third space, right? Third space theory is that people have their primary space, their home. They have their workspace, which is the second space. But a third space is a place you go outside of work or home, like a bar, place to go hang out and just chat with people. And game stores have really leaned into trying to position themselves as a third space, a place people go and hang out. It's something that has always made me, well, not anymore, but it used to make me a little uncomfortable because we're not an events-focused store. We're not a third space in that, hey, come and play a tournament, come and play a casual Magic draft, come and sit and do things. But people tell us all the time that we are that third space. Not because we're focused on come and play a game, that we have the demo bar and we do these other things. They just like coming to hang out, talk to other customers, talk to staff. Whether they buy anything that day or not, doesn't matter. And that is similar to what happens at a con. People go to cons as a third space, right? This is my weekend to go be around fellow game nerds, to do some shopping, to get caught up in the excitement and enthusiasm. So in that way, it's similar. Because people just want to be around the space and around us. And it's an important part of what you create. And I think if I were just to throw a weird plug for other game stores out there that might be listening, remember that being a third space is about more than just having tables to play at. There's so much more that goes into the atmosphere of that.
That is the blue ocean, red ocean thing all over again. When you have the play tables, but you sort of make it clear to people, whether consciously or not, that those play tables are for Warhammer, are for Magic, are for, you know, your local D&D campaigns, you are drawing a thick red Sharpie line around that space that says casuals keep out. Whether you intend that or not, that's what happens. Whenever you say instead, hey, we're going to teach you how to play Cheating Moth at this table today. We're going to teach you how to play Splendor. Why don't we run you through a game of person do thing? You are opening up that space. You are erasing that red line and saying, this is a place anyone can hop into and hop out of at their leisure, at their comfort.
The unique value proposition of a brick and mortar store, the reason people would spend their money here when it's less convenient, you got to drive down here and get something, when it's often more expensive because almost everything is discounted online. We know that, our customers know that. The unique value proposition is that interaction with staff and other customers. It's also our knowledge, sure. That's a huge part of it too. But I think if you're a gamer, if you're into this hobby, yeah, you can go to online forums and you can talk to people that way. But as we talked about at the top of the episode, the internet really focuses on negativity. It focuses on so many things that I might not want to be in the online space talking about my favorite game because it might be full of people, you know, who talk about the right and wrong strategy or this, that, and the other. It's not a place to just sit and bask in the glow of, hey, how excited are we that this thing exists and that we get to play that? And a game store is a place you can come and do that.
But what you're saying, Kylie, is that we are the gaming equivalent of touching grass.
What do you mean by that?
That's been a meme over the past several years when people get all up into some internet arguments, all up into the internet negativity and doom scrolling and all of these things. The solution? Touch grass. Go outside. Go interact with some real flesh and blood people. Go look at a bird.
What we do is amazing and special, and we feel privileged that we get to do it day in and day out, and hopefully this conversation has shown a little bit of why that is, and maybe a little bit more appreciation, even if you don't have a local game store, for what they do as part of the industry.
Hey, we'd love to be your friendly local game store at a distance if you don't have one. But if you do have one, walk in and get that touchgrass moment. Your game store will love you for it.
Absolutely. And tell them they're doing a good job. Hopefully they are doing a good job, but tell them, you know, because we can't just look at the metrics of like, well, we're making money, so yay, we're winning. That feels hollow. But when we get good reviews, when we get that interaction from people, that makes all the difference in the world.
Let's just real quick read one of those reviews that I think exemplifies our blue ocean approach and that of others here in our area that we're also very proud of. We already mentioned Mimics Market. Let's mention Phil up at Game Masters, right? And others that just aren't coming to mind right this moment, but here it is. There are three game stores in my area. At all three, I have had them suggest one of the other stores for something. If I'm not sure about a game and they don't have a demo copy, they'll tell me if one of the other stores has one. Once, I was looking for a specific game they didn't have in stock, and they actually called another store to ask them to set aside a copy for me to buy. They all care about building the community, even if it might cost them a sale, because it helps all of them in the long run. That was from someone not in our area, to my knowledge, but our area very much exemplifies that, and I think it's a beautiful thing for game stores to work together to bring people into that blue ocean with us.
Absolutely. You're going to make me change the subtitle of the podcast from the front lines of the games industry of swimming in the blue ocean of the games industry.
Well, speaking of that blue ocean, what game do you have unfolded on the poop deck of your ship these days?
I just got a chance to play with you. I also played with my family. A game I didn't expect to like I don't know why I didn't expect to like it, but the brand new Stonemaier game, Origin Story.
I love it, yeah.
Yeah, this one, I don't know. I think, you know, Stonemaier, they put out Vantage this year. They put out Finspan. They got big, epic stuff. And people that know Stonemaier, you know, their fans were excited about it. And this is like smaller-ish card game. I knew it had trick-taking involved, which I didn't know it was pretty much a pure trick-taker, which it is. So I was always a little skeptical. Superhero theme. Didn't know how it would meld with trick-taking, but the game is called Origin Story. I love it. I can't wait to play more of it. I'm going away this weekend with some friends, hoping to play this a bunch. It is a trick-taking game. At its core, a pure trick-taking game. There's four suits. Someone's going to lead a card. Everyone has to follow suit. There's a trump suit. Most of the time, you're trying to take tricks. Actually, that's one of the big choices you make every round. It's five rounds. After you've looked at your hand and done some other things, decide. Do you want to be a hero? In which case, you get 1 point per trick you take. Or do you want to be a villain? In which case, you're trying to take no tricks. And if you take no tricks, you get 4 points. Easy peasy. But it's superhero themed, and it's like your origin story. Every round, you're going to get a new special ability. What it really reminds me of is Rebel Princesses, another fantastic trick-taking game. But in that game, you have one special ability for the whole game. In this game, every round you're going to be dealt three new special abilities. You'll choose one of them to keep, but you can only have so much stamina to spend on which special abilities you want to activate for that hand. So based on the hand you have, whether you think you want to go hero or villain, you decide which special abilities to activate. And it's almost like deck building. You are building a stable of special abilities over the course of the game to give you some flexibility in deciding how do I want to play this hand when I get cards dealt to me that maybe look like crap, but I'm going to make it work. So much fun. Again, I think the comparison to Rebel Princesses is apt. If you like Rebel Princesses, this is just that, but more. Can't wait to play more of Origin Story.
Yeah, I do love Origin Story. And if you hadn't picked it, I might have picked it. But it would have been a tough battle anyway between Origin Story and Person Do Thing.
I knew you were going to do that one.
Person do thing from the folks that brought us Smug Owls. So if you like quirky party games, this is a company to watch. Person do thing is a quirky party game in which you have an extremely limited set of words that you must use to describe some concept or other. You know, it can be person, place, thing, idea, action, adjective. It can be any kind of word. And you have a vanishingly small list of words to use to try to get people to figure it out. It is one of those games that sounds a little dull when just described, but let me tell you, everyone who is listening, I have not played a game that has had everyone yelling and laughing around the whole table as much as this one. We had a day recently when two members of staff stuck around for like an hour after their shift had ended because we'd already been playing Person Do Thing for 20 or 30 minutes when their shift was up and they just didn't want to quit playing. So kept on playing, customers walked over and joined us. I mean, I can't say enough about how animated and excited this game gets people. So please, please, please check out Person Do Thing. You will be supporting a small company and getting just a phenomenal social game to add to your library.
I wonder if this is going to be another Katutsi. Like small independent game that most game stores never heard of that we just do gangbusters with. As of time of this recording, Person Do Thing doesn't even have a listing on Board Game Geek. I can't log plays, Chandra. I can't log my plays.
That's crazy. Someone get on that. But also, other game stores, seriously, if you have capacity to run game demos, pick up Person Do Thing. You will have so much fun playing it, but man, is that a great one that I just think everyone should have.
And this is one of those things, this is one of those things where relationships in the game industry come through. I would not have given this game a second glance. Generic party game, whatever. But got an email from the publishers of Smug Owls, which we love and have done real well. This is their next game. I said, okay, we'll give it a try. We brought in a dozen and they were gone in 3 days.
Yep.
It's a good note to end on. Well, as always, thanks for listening to the Unbox Some Funcast, a podcast about being in the blue ocean of the games industry. Next time will be a more freeform episode. We are deep in Q4, so that's going to probably be talking a little bit about the craziness of what happens at a game store during the holiday seasons. Maybe a little bit of a recap of Game Store Day, which happened last weekend. So until then, I'm Kylie here at Games Unlimited.
I'm Chandra.
And you've been listening to the Unbox Some Funcast. Time for you to go unbox some fun.
And touch grass.
Definitely touch grass.